Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
Don't let the mysteries of life scare you away. Instead, ask Altucher. Here's James Altucher.
So, Casey Neistat, I'm really glad you're on the show. You're a huge YouTuber. You get like 13 million views per YouTube video, 500,000 subscribers, but you've also made movies. You've had an HBO series. You're incredibly creative. I have a billion and a half questions for you. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, I hope we can get to all billion and a half in the next 60 minutes, but I'm ready.
Okay, we might not get to a billion and a half, but we're going to get to at least like five.
I'll settle for five.
So, but first I kind of want to ask you, you know, you do something, and this has nothing to do with YouTubing, but you do something that I want my 15-year-old daughter to do, which is you dropped out of high school at the age of 15. And why'd you do that?
Well, I should give some context or preface this by saying I recommend to exactly zero 15-year-olds to drop out of high school.
Why? High school's boring.
Well, I mean, look, I think it's unique for each person, and I would never say that my path has been anything even close to typical, but you know, in life there's like a million different trajectories and you never know where they might lead you. But I'm a staunch believer in education. My son is 16 years old. He's a junior in high school, and he gets very high marks, and if he doesn't, we stop everything and do what we can to correct it, and he'll be going to college. So I'm a big proponent of education. My situation was unique, and I was in a really difficult spot, and I didn't see any other options but leaving school so I could get a job and support my then burgeoning family at age 16.
Wow. So when you say you were in a difficult spot, can you describe what that means?
My son was born pregnant with my son when I was 16 years old. So, you know, I didn't really have family to turn to take care of me. I didn't have anyone else. You know, I was on my own. So it was up to me to figure out how to support my newborn baby. And the only way to do that was to work, not to stay in school. So I didn't have a lot of choice, a lot of options.
So obviously you were scared, but don't you think that fear became
almost like what catapulted you into the creative successes you had later. And I'm not trying to kind of force you into kind of my own plot line here, but do you think it was a catalyst?
Yeah, I mean, look, well, first of all, I wasn't scared. I think that's a mischaracterization. Fear never played any part of it. I think it was purely based on necessity and practicality. Never make decisions out of fear, and I don't think I ever have. But I don't think that anyone who's found any level of success in their life, I don't think they could ever point to any one thing that yielded to that success. And certainly, I'm no different. It's I've had a lot of ups and downs in my career. I'm still a young guy. I feel like my career is still just starting at age 33. And certainly looking back at the decisions I made, whether they're decisions I had to make or decisions I choose to make, I wouldn't change the path that I took. But again, I wouldn't say that it's literally a path I would recommend. I think that always choosing, following your passion, and then always choosing whatever instinct says to do it at that given time in life is the very best you can do.
And
that's what I did.
And let me ask you, like, career, I sort of feel nowadays, is kind of an umbrella term. Like it's not like you go to an office and sit in a cubicle and do your job. Like, you kind of do things from making YouTube videos to running essentially a new type of ad agency to, making movies. Like, clearly you've taken your creative talents and applied it in several different directions. What would you say you're most focused on? I mean, is it the YouTube videos? We've done about 100 of them. Is it the ad agency? Is it kind of figuring out whether you're going to go towards, full-blown movie making? What do you like to do right now?
Well, I mean, I think in life you can get a job like you're describing, working in an office, or you can invent a job or you can create a job. And I think that I fall into the latter category, where my aspirations and my goals of how I spend the majority of my time and how I make a living, they certainly don't now practically fall into any boxes or any sort of predetermined categories. So I very much consider what I do a job, and I take my career and my job very seriously. But it's atypical. But that said, what is my main focus? I just started another company. I recently started a technology company that's my primary focus now. Making YouTube videos is my absolute passion, and like you mentioned, I spent a lot of time working in television, and I've produced two very successful feature films, and I've worked a lot, and I've worked in sort of every manifestation of video making there is, and nothing really turns me on, nothing excites me as much as YouTube. So
let's talk about that, because I want to ask you about all these things, but let's talk about the YouTube videos, because they have a very particular style that I think is particular to YouTube. It's like a combination of you have a point you're making. There's a lot of fast cutting. I mean, there's hundreds of scenes maybe in a 3 minute video, and there's a lot of humor in the videos. Like, what was the first one? How did you start kind of building up your YouTube style? How did you notice that? How did you measure success in this area? Do you make money from the YouTube videos? It's a lot of questions in once.
Yeah, it's a lot of questions. Let me start by giving my YouTube career a little bit of context. And that's that I succeeded first in the mainstream media world, so feature films and television, and I had my own show on HBO that I wrote and directed and starred in. And I chose to leave mainstream media for YouTube, which is somewhat antithetical to most YouTubers' trajectories, or at least aspirations. And the reason why I did that is because whether it's YouTube or Vimeo or any sort of free-to-access online distribution platform, what excites me about that is the accessibility of it, is the egalitarian aspect of it. And what that means more acutely is, you know, like, in order for me to sell my show to HBO, there was a lot of politics involved. I had, you know, very powerful friends helping me set up meetings, and I had our executive producer was a very well-connected guy, and there was nepotism, and we were in the right place in the right time, and there was all this sort of all of these external factors that preceded that show actually being sold to HBO. And none of that is what I'm interested in. None of that is what I care about. And more importantly, when I speak to young people who have goals and ambitions to work in the movie world, they don't have access to those things. And it just seems unfair, and it seems somewhat elitist. And I think that work should only ever be judged on the merit and the quality of the movies, not the sort of political nonsense that pollutes so much of that industry. So in deciding to depart from mainstream and focus on YouTube, it was because of the democratic aspects of YouTube. You know, YouTube and the internet is a meritocracy. If it's good, it will find its audience. And that, to me, is the most exciting part of distributing online. That, to me, is why my passion and my main focus as a filmmaker is not getting another movie into the Cannes Film Festival, but is to make another YouTube movie that, you know, that a couple hundred thousand people want to see.
Let me ask you, if you made a YouTube video, now that you've had a wide range of success with YouTube, if you make a YouTube video that only had like 50,000 views, would you get upset at yourself, or would you figure, okay, I'm on to the next video?
No, I mean, look, I think that if you start to cater or pander to an audience in any capacity, in any form of artistic expression, then you've already failed. So to try to study what videos get the most views and try to, you know, find a consistency in the movies that the audience responds to the best, I think that you're selling yourself short as a creator.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but yet I do look at all of your videos and I study them and I try to figure out what works, because let's say I want to make YouTube videos, I'm going to try to learn from the guy who has 13 million views on videos.
Well, sure. Look, it's always the artist's job to create the new cliches, but I think that's very different from what you're describing is very different from the question, which is, do I try to make movies that get a lot of views, or do I get upset when I don't get a lot of views? And the answer is a definitive and absolute no. I really don't give a shit whether a movie gets 50,000 views or 14 million views. My most watched movie on my channel, I would say, is nowhere near what I consider to be my best movie on my channel. I don't even think it's in the top 20 best movies on my channel. And why it succeeded is based on a series of metrics that I don't think really speak to its quality as a movie, but I think people think it's fun and people think it's silly and they laugh and they smile at it and it makes their day better. So it has 14.5 million views, but, you know, I have a movie on my channel that took me a 2 years to make, and it's 23 minutes long, and it's got a couple hundred thousand views. And to me, that's a movie I'd rather be judged by. And the fact that it has, you know, 10% of the viewership of, or less than that, of my most watched movie, doesn't really matter to me. So I think it's the quality of the work that lasts, quality endures.
The average movie, my guess is, it's one shot or two shots, and then they upload it to YouTube and expect views. How much work? Like you just said, you took a year to make a YouTube video. How many hours of footage do you say would you shoot on average for, like, let's say, a 5-minute YouTube video?
I mean, there's very little consistency in the productions. You know, a movie like Bike Lanes, I made that in a day. Like my snowboarding New York City movie, I made that in 2 days. But
okay, let's talk about Bike Lane for a second, because that was you got ticketed for riding outside the bike lane, and your whole thing was that it's quite safe. In fact, it's even more safe in many cases to ride outside the bike lane, and you want your $50 fine back. And so you kept driving into obstructions, and I have to admit, I'm like a 2-year-old. Every time you hit like a garbage can or a police car and fell over, I laughed. Like there was just basic humor in it.
Yeah, and look, I wasn't arguing that it's safer to not be in the bike lanes. I was just trying to illustrate a point that always being in the bike lanes is a completely impractical rule to enforce. And honestly, it's the conclusion of the video that it's not actually a law, and you're not required by any laws to be inside of the bike lane. So the whole thing was just a little bit preposterous. But yeah, look, I don't think there's anything interesting about the argument that police shouldn't be ticketing cyclists for riding in the street. I think that's a pretty uninteresting story. I think seeing somebody get a $50 ticket for summons for riding outside of the bike lane is a pretty uninteresting story. So in trying to make that interesting, yeah, physical humor. I mean, everybody loves to laugh. And I think if I just uploaded a two-minute documentary about me getting a ticket, I don't think anybody would have cared. But if you can coat that medicine with a little bit of sugar and make it fun and make it a great time to watch and make it something that makes people laugh, then people will engage. And the truth is, like, you know, for every 100 people that watched that movie and thought it was hysterical, there's one person that's like, you know, that's a silly rule and that shouldn't exist. So I think that it was that movie was a real success in sort of communicating my frustration, but at the same time making a piece of content that people love to watch.
What was the first YouTube video that you realized, hey, this is going to be a great medium for me to do videos in? Like, what kind of, like, was the first catalyst for that?
I mean, I don't know. You know, it was more the aspect of, you know, the democratic aspect of distributing online that got me excited, and not any one piece of content.
What I mean, you've obviously also been using YouTube a little bit in your ad agency work. Like, you have the video Make It Count, where, you know, ostensibly the idea is Nike is giving you this money to make a video, and then you get this sense in the beginning that you're stealing this money to travel around the world. But, you know, my guess is that was part of the story. Like, then that was a funny movie, too, just because of how it began.
Stealing is a really aggressive word. There was never any theft taking place, but I was commissioned by Nike, hired by Nike to make a promotional video around the idea of Make It Count. And I had pitched one idea, and kind of at the ninth hour, I decided I didn't want to do that idea. And I had a different idea that was a little bit crazy and much harder to get permission for, so I didn't. And instead, I realized my idea. But I think if you were to ask Nike right now, they'd tell you that there was no ill will there, and they were really excited about what I was doing. But it was not the agreed upon plan. And I think that tension of, like, taking a real risk was really in parity with the idea of, like, making it count. And here I was handed this opportunity by Nike, and rather than taking the traditional path and executing on what was originally agreed on, I thought I would make it count and really just go for it and do something I've always wanted to do. And in the end, you know, that movie was ended up being one of the most watched online videos that he's ever made.
Well, you know, I think this idea of taking a risk is very important because, for instance, you don't see that in a lot of either YouTube videos or ads or whatever. And I think with all of your videos, there's this notion of taking a risk. And do you consciously think about that when planning out a YouTube video? Like, what's the process when planning out a YouTube video that, of course, inevitably is going to go viral?
I mean, there's very little. I never know what the movie is going to be when I start doing it. It's just an idea. And then that idea matures in the execution. So that's why I always petition for, you know, ideas matter very little. And I honestly don't really care much for ideas. It's execution that matters. So if you were to take any of my movies and reduce them to a single idea, you would find an idea that's been done a million times before. There's nothing truly original about traveling the world, and there's nothing original about being mad at a police officer, and there's nothing unique about, you know, going on vacation with my kid. But it's in the execution that I'm able to sort of tell a story that I think and I hope people relate to.
And what do you, and in the execution, what do you like to do? Like, what do you like to do that you feel will improve the quality of the video?
Something I always strive for is to capture a level of honesty. And I think that's really challenging. I think that's something that is very hard to do when you're starting out in a career. How do you capture what is actually going on? How do you capture what you're actually experiencing? And I mean that in a literal way, but I also mean that in a visceral way. How do you you know, how do you capture the emotion of a moment? How do you capture the emotion of an experience and capture it in a way that's easily communicated? And that's something that I struggle with all the time. You know, I have friends that are daily vloggers, and I try to imagine daily vlogging, and I can't, because I feel like the camera would dictate my lifestyle and not the other way around, and they would become inherently dishonest. So, yeah, I mean, look, one of my principles in all filmmaking is to be as honest as I possibly can, and that's something that I'm pretty conscious of.
But I think that honesty implies a risk. So, for instance, like in your video of Surprise in South Africa, you're going to visit your girlfriend who's in South Africa, you're in the U.S., and it's a surprise. And along the way, we document you along the way, but when you land in South Africa, you really don't know where you're going. And it's kind of funny, you say to the cab driver, okay, this is definitely it. Then you say, no, this is not it. And you're getting closer and closer, and then you have no idea really how she's going to react. So there's this huge risk component that adds to the tension of the video. And like I said, there's a lot of one or 2 second segments in this video. I mean, there's hours of footage I'm sure you took, or, you know, it wasn't the easiest video to make, but the risk is throughout. And I think that risk is the honesty.
Yeah, but look, the risk that's portrayed in my movies is not done for the movies. I would say that, you know, risk is something I've never been averse to in any aspect of my life, and anything that I do, from business to personal to, you know, to making movies or telling stories or, you know, running marathons. I'm not a risk averse person. I embrace risk, and I'm someone who deeply believes that life shrinks and expands in direct proportion to your willingness to assume risk. So, I've never shied away from risk in anything I do. And I think the most dangerous lifestyle anyone can live is a lifestyle where you play it safe. And that tends to transcend everything I do, from making movies to, you know, to relationships and friendships and family and everything in between.
And to be honest, I think that's what comes through in these videos and why people like them. I think not that everybody lives a life free of risk, but, you know, as the word implies, people are afraid of that risk to some extent. And here you are embracing it in these videos, and then the video goes viral. I mean, I'm sure you don't have like a standard technique for, okay, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and now the video is going to go viral. But that's the thing I see most in common in these videos, as opposed to other videos out there.
I think that's just something that people are able to relate to. I think it's highly relatable. I think that, me going and chasing after a girl on the other side of the planet is just a level of passion that people can understand. And maybe people don't have the means or the resources or access or wherewithal to jump on a plane and say, the hell with it, and fly 30 hours to go chase after a girl. But certainly the motive is something that's highly relatable. And that's where it comes back to the honesty. If that motive isn't honest and isn't true, then I think people might be more inclined to reject it instead of embrace it, like you're describing.
And then what makes you decide on a particular adventure in your life? Like, let's say this one. Okay, this is the one I'm going to make a video about. Because you don't make videos on your life every day. It's like, has to be a particular level of message or intensity.
I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think some of my movies are about pretty mundane things, like buying a new wallet or, you know, hanging out with my kid. But, I don't know. The decision point is just whether or not I make the movie or finish the movie. For every experience or story or adventure that I share in one of my movies, there's 10 behind it that there's no public documentation of. So, it's a purely a matter of resources. I have a notebook that sits on my desk, James, that has 160 pages full in it, and each one of those pages is an idea, and those are all ideas that I've captured in one way or another but have yet to turn into anything. So it's just a matter of resources. If I had no other responsibilities in the world at all the time, all the free time I had ever want, I'd probably be cranking out 4 movies a week about things that I care about or ideas that I want to share. But I lack that. So instead, it's a... I pick and choose, and whatever I have the wherewithal to actually get through or realize is what I end up sharing.
And, okay, so what's the tech company that you're involved in or that you're starting?
It's a project that I, you know, it's an idea that I sort of incubated and focused on and started to become more serious about at the beginning of last year. And now it's become a much larger focus in my life, but it's not so far off from what I'm currently focused on. It's just about new ways to share video, and hopefully helping other people share video in an easier way, because right now it's still pretty complicated.
What's complicated right now about sharing video?
There's a lot of steps to it. I have a friend of mine who, when her SD card, her video camera fills up, she buys a new SD card. And I don't think there's anything unique about that, but I think what it does highlight is it highlights there's a lot involved. You know, I would say for every minute of footage that I edit, it takes me, you know, 20 hours of work to realize that 1 minute. And I think for every video that I upload on YouTube, there's a few hundred million of videos that other people are uploading that nobody's seeing. I just think that making movies is still really hard, and there's an opportunity for technology to make it easier. And we're already seeing that happen. You know, I think like GoPro has done a really great job of making it easy for young people or new people to capture things that they otherwise would never be able to capture. And I think things like iMovie, you know, iMovie was my catalyst for getting into filmmaking in like 99 or 2000, whenever iMovie 1 came out. That was when I was like, wow, I can make a movie now. And that trend in technology is something that's really exciting for me, because I think the more tools that people have to share their ideas and perspectives, ultimately the more empathetic the world can become.
So let's say I'm sitting in a cubicle somewhere and I'm listening to this interview and I'm thinking to myself, boy, I'd really like to start making YouTube videos and having fun with it, and maybe even eventually making a living out of it. What kind of guidance would you give?
I'd say stop listening to this podcast and get back to work, because if you want to make YouTube videos, you need to have a job to be able to pay for your cameras and pay for your equipment and pay for your free time to actually make them. As far as doing it for a living, I think it's a terrible idea, and I would advise everyone against it. I think that you should always make a living so you can make movies. Don't make movies so you can make a living.
Okay, so let's take it a different approach. I want to make the most creative movies possible, and I have no idea how. What guidance would you give then?
You buy a camera, use your cell phone, whatever means you have to capture and make something, and it will be terrible. And when it's done, start again and make something, and it'll be maybe a little bit less terrible. And keep doing that until you find your voice. And I don't mean that to sound pandering or dismissive, but the first 3 years of me making videos, and when I was young and started making movies, I was making five a week. They're all unwatchable. They're terrible. They're horrible. But it takes that kind of investment before you're able to find your voice. And so, I think that if you look at most painters and you look at most musicians and you look at most people that have chosen a path of creativity in their careers, their initial, you know, tenure of creating, it wasn't creating the amazing work that you or I might know them for. But that's something they had to work towards and discover, and making movies is no different.
And did you, during those 3 years, and that's like five a week, 750 videos or whatever, did you find yourself getting disappointed at any point? Like, were you thinking, ugh, I can't do this anymore?
No, I was just excited to be doing it. It was just something that made me happy. You know, I was working 50 hours a week in the kitchen of a seafood restaurant then. I was the dishwasher in a restaurant, and I worked 50 hours a week, and in my free time when the baby was asleep, I would be editing videos, and when the baby was awake, he would be the star of my little movies, and that was my life.
And then at what point did you realize, whoa, I just did something that everybody liked? What was the first big video?
I mean, that was 5 years later. That was after, you know, moving to New York City. That was after quitting my job in a restaurant. That was a process. There was never a switch. There was never an overnight moment of realization or success. It was all a very slow, very challenging crawl to, you know, to finding my voice and ultimately finding your career. But as far as the first video that really popped, made a movie with my brother Dan in 2003 about the original iPod. And that movie was really reached a lot of people, considering it was 3 years prior to YouTube even being out there. It was just posted on a splash page, and it was still seen by several million people. So that was the first time I did something that really had some reach.
And it had an effect, too. I mean, I think there was even a class action suit around Apple's battery on the iPod that they had to take care of.
Yeah, a class action suit I did not participate in, nor was I any part of, but it was certainly initiated because of the movie that we had made.
And then what happened after that? Did you get any calls saying, hey, can you make a video for me?
No, not at all. Just went back to work and kept making more and more movies. You know, it's like, it's the best metaphor I can give is it's like being stranded in the middle of the ocean and paddling. And, you know, you paddle for weeks and months and months and you don't even see the shore, let alone get closer to it. But you just have to sort of trust blindly that each one of those strokes is going to get you a little bit closer to where you want to be. So when I look back at the early years of my career, that's what it was.
And when were the first inbound calls where they said, hey, Nike calls and says, hey, can you make a video around the idea of Make It Count?
I mean, that doesn't happen. Make It Count was, you know, 2012. That was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. That was after working in this industry a decade. But yeah, you know, it was like the first gigs I got paid for were like making terrible wedding videos and birthday videos for $150. It wasn't Nike calling. Nike never called. You know, I was 31 years old before Nike called. But, you know, having the humility to like edit someone's acting reel for $50, you know, that was the kind of, those were the kind of calls I got in those years.
So really, but that, you know, the side effect of that is, of course, really building up your skill set.
I guess. I mean, I think building up a skill set is something that happens, not editing acting reels. I think it's building up your skill set happens just via self-discipline and really keeping your head down and focus work and nothing else and just having some sort of faith that maybe eventually with a lot of hard work and a tiny bit of luck that it might lead me somewhere before I die.
You know, and again, on the path of someone finding their voice, often they study, you know, people who have come before them. And this happens in every field of art or entrepreneurship or whatever. Like what either YouTubers or filmmakers do you recommend, or writers, do you recommend people study on their path?
Malcolm X. I'm a pretty huge fan of Malcolm X. You know,
all his videos?
Malcolm X entered prison as a degenerate and a criminal, and he took on, you know, he was the quintessential autodidact. And while he was in prison, he read so much, he developed astigmatism in both eyes, and that's why he wore glasses. But he took that time in prison to educate himself. And when he left prison, he became, you know, one of the best communicators of our time, and certainly of the civil rights movement. But that's something that I find hugely aspirational, or those kinds of things. You know, I'm a big fan, and when it comes to filmmaking, I'm a big fan of Werner Herzog. And I'm less of a fan of Werner Herzog because of his films, and I'm more of a fan of Werner Herzog because of his message and the ideas that he shares. And, you know, him very famously saying that if you were to start a film school, the application process would be to walk from Paris to Berlin and keep a diary of that journey. And that's what you'd hand in. And if you had a film school, there'd be no cameras, but you'd learn things like how to box. That kind of, those kinds of ideas are ideas that I love.
Where did he say that stuff? I want to refer people to it.
To learn about Werner Herzog, I would recommend reading Herzog on Herzog. It's a really fantastic book that sort of encapsulates a lot of what he's done. I mean, you don't have to dig deep to find a lot of great stuff about Werner Herzog, but Herzog on Herzog is where I'd start. And, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X, I think, is one of the greatest, most important pieces of nonfiction, certainly in my career.
And what other YouTubers do you like?
What other YouTubers do I like? You know, I don't know. I spend a shockingly small amount of time watching videos on YouTube. Mostly I just watch, like, cat videos and silly things like that. I'm not a big consumer on YouTube.
Well, you know, also I've noticed you've been playing around, obviously, with many other, not just YouTube, but you did a whole video about why Snapchat is kind of the next potentially big video platform. Do you see yourself playing with all of these different platforms and trying to master each one of them?
No, absolutely not. I think that would probably be a pretty big waste of time. I've never really used Vine. Vine's not really for me. I don't think I can tell a story on Vine. I think it's an interesting platform, and people are doing great work on there, but it's not for me. Same with Instagram. I think Instagram's an amazing place to share pictures, but for video, I don't think it's great. But I like Snapchat. Snapchat is a way for me to share little ideas and little thoughts in a real-time way to an audience that's interested in those kinds of ideas. I wouldn't call what's being done on Snapchat filmmaking by any means, but I think it's another really effective means of disseminating ideas and perspectives, and ultimately that's what excites me more than anything else.
Well, Casey, I really appreciate you spending the time. I think this is one of the few interviews I've had where it's great. Everything you said is great. You've probably disagreed with me on every single thing I've said in this interview, which is fine. That's totally great because I learned a lot. You know, one thing I'm always curious about, what, for you, what's humor? Because obviously there's humor in every one of your videos. What for you kind of stand, when you're editing a video, because clearly I see your videos are heavily edited. When you're editing a video, what stands out as humor?
I mean, I think humor is anything that makes you smile. I don't know that I'd need to go any deeper than that, but if you see something, you hear something, you feel something that makes you smile, then there's humor in that. And I think that there are few things in this world more valuable than humor, and I love it when someone else makes me smile. I can tell you what I don't think is funny. What I don't think is humor is when that smile or that laugh comes at the expense of someone else. And that's why prank videos are among my least favorite genre on YouTube or anything else, is because I don't think laughing or smiling or having fun at someone else's expense is ever okay. And that's why I have nothing but disdain for prank videos.
No, and I think a lot of your videos have this element of self-deprecation in them, which is in itself funny. You essentially remove skills from yourself while making the video. So again, you know, the surprise in South Africa, first you know where you're going, then you don't. Like, you remove the skill, and that's funny.
Yeah, look, and that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, James, where I think honesty and truthfulness at the heart of everything that I try to do, because that really is who I am. Like, I would never want to misrepresent myself by pretending or portraying myself as being smarter than I or more informed than I actually am. And more often than not, I find myself in situations where I have no idea what I'm doing. And I feel no shame in revealing that.
And I think, to be honest, that is the most important message. That's the key to any artistic form. If people really want to go for it, that's the way you stand out. Because most people are afraid to admit those moments, I think.
Well, I think most people are afraid of vulnerability. And I think that that's that's a shame, and that's something I'll never really get because we all have moments of vulnerability. It's something that we can all relate to. So why try to mask that? Why try to present yourself as anything but human?
Excellent. Well, Casey, thanks so much. I'm going to keep watching your videos. I recommend everybody go to Casey Neistat, N-E-I-S-T-A-T's YouTube channel, and wherever else. Where else do you want to send people, if anywhere?
YouTube's good.
So watch that. I recommend people watch the Nike Make It Count video. Watch the Surprise in South Africa video. Are there any other favorites you really want to direct people to?
I don't know. You know, my favorite one is the one I made with my son. It's called My Kid and Me. That's something that I'm particularly proud of.
And also, of course, the classic High Heels on a Treadmill. Very good video.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Casey. I really appreciate this.
You got it. Good speaking to you. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Now that's what we call done. Visit StansberryRadioChooseYourself.com to download our free report called The Choose Yourself Stories and check back daily for more Ask Altucher.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.